From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 12th day of July 2010. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk with Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, about today's agricultural markets. And then later in the program, we'll hear from Daryl Good. He'll help recap what happened in Friday morning's USDA WASDE numbers. A bit later after that, we'll talk with the folks at the Andersons about the cash grain market. And as we close out our session today in the second half of the program, we'll discuss succession planning or how to pass down the farm. Kevin Spafford of the Farm Journal Electronic Media Legacy Project will be here. And it all happens on this Monday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
The Closing Market Report is made possible in part by a grant from Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services in Oakland, Illinois, a full-service commodities firm with two toll-free lines. In Illinois, 800-252-2013. In Indiana, 800-637-3123. Or email to cooley at admworld.com.
In Chicago on the Monday afternoon, futures finished the day like this. Nearby July wheat at $5.21¼, down 2¼. September for the soft red at $5.35¾ to 1¼ lower, and December wheat futures $5.64¼, down 2¼. The hard red in Kansas City did manage to make a gain of the day, up $0.03¼ at $5.50 for the July harvest month there. July corn futures back in Chicago, $3.71¼, settlement price down 4¢. September, $3.79¾, 3¾ lower. December, $3.91¾, down 3½. And the March corn at $4.03½, down 3½¢. The May futures, $4.11¼, down 3¾. July soybeans at $10.31¾, up 6¼. The August, $9.97¾, 4½¢ higher. September at $9.66½, unchanged. November at $9.51, down 2¼. And January futures at $9.60, down 2¼. March futures $9.63¼, down 2¼. July bean meal at $3.14.80, up 70. July bean oil at $37.50, down 12½¢, or down 12¢ for the day. August live cattle futures were the finished 12½ lower at $90.07½. August feeders at $112.67½, 52½¢ lower. And July lean hogs today, $78.12½ there. They finished down 50 cents in Chicago from the CME Group. You are listening to the Closing Market Report from the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures on the day at $74.95 a barrel, down $1.14. And the fuel for ethanol at $1.58¢, down $0.03¢ for the day. Natural gas at $4.39¢, that's just about 0.9¢ lower. And the RBOB at $2.03¢, down 3¢ Diesel fuel or heating oil at $1.99¢, down 3¢ on the afternoon. Gold futures at $1,198.50 an ounce, finished $11.10 lower, and the Dow Jones Industrial Average at 10,199, currently just about one and eight tenths of a point higher on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast looks like from Drew Lerner. He says dryness remains from the east central part of Illinois right through northwestern Ohio and into the southeastern parts of Michigan. Significant rainfall in the eastern Midwest may not fall, although some periodic showers are likely over the next 10 days. Greater rain is needed, of course, in the eastern portion of the Midwest and specifically in the area noted above, which was from east central Illinois through the northwestern part of Ohio and southeastern part of Michigan. Greater rain needed in those areas. Western Corn Belt has plenty of moisture at this time. Seasonable temperatures, scattered showers, a few thunderstorms will continue into next week, says Mr. Lerner, with some resulting rainfall. It should be highly variable, though, often too light to counter any of the evaporation that will be taking place under the warm conditions. Subsoil moisture should remain favorable over the next 10 days. High pressure ridge is expected in the western Corn Belt next week. That may reach into Illinois and Missouri for a brief period of time. More on the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour and we talk with the folks in Chicago at Chesapeake Energy.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
This is the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. Kurt Kimmel of Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois, joins us to take a look at the agricultural futures markets. Good afternoon to you, Kurt.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Well, we've had some time, including a weekend, to absorb what USDA did on Friday morning of last week. What did the rollout finally look like from USDA and the fallout in Chicago?
Well, I think the market's pretty well priced in the report, I think there's more fallout coming as time goes on. They sort of laid the groundwork for some revisions to occur. And as we all know, the number one revision or change will be the yield that we try to put on this crop. You take yield times harvested acres, and boy, that can change the bottom line quite a bit. You can go to our website, basecom.net, and get a supply-demand balance sheet and play with that yield. It moves it up and down. That's the big debate here. You dial back the clock 2 weeks ago. Some analysts were looking at corn yields as high as 167, 170 bushel the acre. Those same analysts took her clear down to 160, 161. Now they brought it back up to 163. So it's going to be a challenge to plug some type of yield on the corn and bean crop as we move along here. This afternoon's crop conditions report will be a clue that a lot of people watch to try to get an idea where we are as far as the conditions go. But it's so highly variable, it's going to be awful tough to get a good solid average. This market's going to be a dynamic market clear into the January report, as we really won't know the real answer until we get wrapped up with harvest, Todd.
Did the trade have much of an expectation with this afternoon's report and looking forward to a drop in the condition for corn?
I've heard probably the most popular idea of maybe 1% to 2% drop, and I've heard as much as 3% to 4% drop out of a good to excellent category. We'll see where it falls. Probably the key is in what areas. Minnesota has been the one that's had the highest crop ratings. They've got the most room to drop if they do. They've been up in the 80%. But you take Illinois corn and Iowa corn in the mid-60s here, and you start, you know, whittling away on that. That's pretty big producers there, and you know, and you're sort of taking the top end off. You know, you got corn out there knee-high, not waist high, starting to put tassels on, and I don't care if it's GMO corn or triple stack or quadruple stack, it's not going to produce 200 bushel. And you got areas out there where it's just plain bare. And that's, I've tried to get averages to go up. I have an awful hard time to get averages to go up on that type. Another, you know, example too is had a producer going his beans. He had like 280 acres, and he went in and filled the holes in, and he ended up with 70 acres of new beans going in the ground here a week ago. And that's not counting the thin areas. That's just the areas that were bare. So our best guess is we'll argue yield for the next month, 2 months. Then the topic might be sooner than that, but will be actual harvested acres, Todd.
And eventually we'll get around again to what the ending stocks might be. USDA on Friday morning, and these are estimates, but about a 1.5, it was just under that, and just under a 1.4 for next year, so 1.5 billion bushel carryover when we get to this fall, 1.4, a little under that, when we get to the fall after that, or the fall of 2011. These are pretty tight stocks numbers, things that we haven't really seen for quite some time, but the market doesn't seem all that worked up about it at this point.
Well, we rallied corn 50 cents off the low, just in a heartbeat, and you know, same thing with wheat and beans. So we priced part of that in, and historically we're looking at tighter stocks, but not extremely tight. So it's going to be real critical to watch that bottom line as we move more forward here. You start taking corn ending stocks closer to the billion bushel, the trade's going to get more and more excited about because the end user's really not covered here, and that'll push the urgency to get some more coverage on. And technical-wise, we're messing around with the 200-day moving average on beans right here at these levels on the new crop, that is. And these corn, I believe, is around 402. So you start closing above the 200-day moving average, and you'll start to see New York or the fund money come in a little bit more aggressive wanting to own it. Now, I'm not painting a picture where if you're a producer and don't have things sold, don't hang on, because the same thing is if we get more favorable weather and this world economy takes a step back, we could see a correction back the other way. So I'm not trying to paint a picture to hang on in through here. I still, as a producer, feel that we need to use strength in here to get caught up on sales and get to where we need to be.
Yeah, that seems to be a running theme with most of our analysts, that they look out and they feel friendly, and they'd almost like to be bullish the corn and the soybeans, but they're suggesting that producers be caught up on sales at a minimum at this point in both of those crops, old and new crop.
Yeah, there's some real creative strategies out there. If you don't want to sell the physical crop price ahead because you're a little uncertain, then there's some option strategies out there. You can put a price floor under you for only 5 to 10 cents using some spreads and so forth. But if you're one comfortable and got some sloping ground that's received some favorable weather and feel you're going to be in this 230, 240 bushel area, need to sell more, but think we can go higher, you can move the cash if the basis isn't too wide and replace ownership on paper. By the same standpoint, there's a little carry in the marketplace, too, on corn that's going to reward you for hedging the deferred contracts and storing it too tight. So there's a lot of creative ideas out there. I don't have the luxury to listen to your program, but I'm sure everybody's got some good ideas. The key is to find something you're comfortable with, because this is going to be quite a dynamic market going clear into January of 2011.
Kurt, thanks so much.
Very good.
Kurt Kimmel is with Bates Commodities out of Normal, Illinois. He joins us here on the Closing Mark Report. That happens each and every Monday afternoon. You can listen to Kurt again if you'd like in a couple of ways. You can pick it up off our website at willag.org. Sign up to have the podcast delivered automatically to your computer there. Just listen directly from the website at willag.org. Or dial this number, 217-333-3434. We update it with a bit of the analysis from either the opening or the closing mark report and some of the numbers at 10:15 and 3:15 each and every business day of the year.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baesdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
In today's agricultural news, Monsanto says it will maintain export market approvals for the first biotech soybean trait, that's Roundup Ready, through 2021. But the National Farmers Union president, Roger Johnson, says there's more to the process. NFU does not believe this is the sole answer to a timely and enforceable mechanism, it says, to ensure the generic competition arrives in biotech seeds as soon as the RR1 patent expires. Johnson explains, because the patent for these soybeans expires in 2014, the immediate development of generic-based products or timely access to regulatory data so that new seeds containing the generic version of Roundup needs to be available to farmers in 2015. Well, kudos to the Farm Safety Agency's Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack and Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius commended federal food safety agencies for their accomplishments supporting the charge of President Obama's Food Safety Working Group, which advises the president on how to upgrade the U.S. food safety system. The Food Safety Working Group, chaired by Vilsack and Sebelius, recommended a public health-focused approach to food safety based on three core principles: prioritizing prevention, strengthening inspection enforcement, and improving response and recovery. From food safety, we'll move to floodplain protection. Producers who fall victim to breached reservoir levees may benefit from research conducted at the Agricultural Research Service Watershed Physical Processes Research Unit. That's in Oxford, Mississippi. That's where researchers developed a new barrier design that can protect reservoir levees from the erosive forces of wind-driven waves. Results indicate that a floating barrier held in place by two rows of pilings would provide the most effective embankment protection from wave action. Since the barrier was confined between the two rows of pylons, it could rise and fall with fluctuating water levels, unlike a barrier tethered to the bottom of the pond that might become submerged by rising water levels. And finally today, projects have been approved for conservation practices implementation. 26 projects in 15 states will help farmers and ranchers implement conservation practices on agricultural and non-industrial private forest lands through the Cooperative Conservation Partnership Initiative. The CCPI helps agricultural producers achieve natural resources benefits like clean air, clean water, productive soils, and abundant wildlife. USDA will provide nearly $7 million in financial assistance in fiscal year 2010 through CCPI, which is administered by the Natural Resources Conservation Service. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. Please do visit our website. The address is willag.org. As you know, last Friday, USDA released the latest WASDE, or World Agricultural Supply and Demand Estimates. Let's go back through some of those numbers today and what they might mean for the corn market and farmers. Farmers across the Midwest have watched their corn crop look good and then bad and then good and then, well, they're not quite sure other than that the price of corn should go higher. They've turned bullish, says University of Illinois ag economist Darrell Good.
You know, I think that really is the case. You know, last half of June, prices were sliding pretty hard. Everybody got really negative. The USDA June 30 reports really was a game changer. We have a very sharp rally following that. Now, as bearish as everybody was 3 weeks ago, they're as bullish now. I think we're seeing December corn push back up towards that $4 mark. Seems to me that, you know, that's kind of in line with our recent high. We may have a little difficulty right now pushing above $4 December corn. But if the market does get really a little bit more worried about production, and at the same time we can hold the demand side of the market together, then you might start talking, okay, let's look at those late winter highs. Where were we before we got that really shocking January production report? And, you know, that's 40, 50 cents above where the market is right now. That seems like a long shot to get back to 4.5 D's corn. I think it would take some stress on the crop, maybe some confirmation that yields are not quite as high as we thought just a month ago.
Without the stress, without confirmation, yield has been cut. Darrell Good thinks the top end of the USDA season's average cash price for corn is about right at $4.05 a bushel.
At the top end of USDA's range of 405, again, that's a 12-month average. That would say December corn ought to go to the 410 level or so, and then you add the carry into next summer would give you a season's average cash price of this 405 that's at the top end of the range. So, you know, it does say there's, even from USDA's numbers, they're saying 15 cents higher in the market would not be a surprise at this point.
That's 410 a bushel corn on the board, not out of the field. Since prices at the time of this writing were near $4 December, Darrell Good says it's time to let go of any remaining old crop corn stocks and maybe even to sell a little new crop corn, too. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866 1-800-837-9027.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Monday afternoon. Time to check the cash grain markets. On the phone line with us, Brian Stark of the Andersons right here in Champaign County. How are you, Brian?
Good, Todd. How are you?
No, I'm very well. Have you been taking much corn in?
A little bit. It's slowed down quite a bit, and I don't know if that's the producer still trying to figure out what he's going to do with his damage or why exactly. We ran at a pretty good pace in June, but the last 10 days or first 10 days in July, been kind of slowing down the pace of old crop deliveries.
Quality's not been that great then?
Quality's not that great. We continue to see damage come in, and I think it's obviously a problem anywhere you look. I've talked to other elevators throughout the state, and everybody seems to be dealing with the same issues. Poor quality corn. I think this is not surprising the way the crop came off last fall, the delay lasting until January, and just an overall poor quality crop. And the longer it's being held on farm, I think the tougher it's going to get.
And you're getting poor quality beans in as well?
No, actually, beans are kind of hard to find these days. I think the processors sniff them out. Whatever few beans that are left, they go directly there. So we haven't seen many beans come in the elevator in a while.
How bad are you having to dock guys when corn comes in?
Well, I think right now the discounts for damage have been raised, and obviously will continue to be reevaluated because it's an impact at this point to say that it's going to be tough to blend off all the old crop without getting to new. So there's probably going to be some carry-in for us, and because of that, there's more risk involved. So damage scales have gone higher, and I anticipate that that will stay in effect at least until new crop.
That might have something to do with producers not bringing it in too, I suppose.
It could, but I think at some point they're going to have to either look at potentially trying to blend themselves on the farm, which is often tough to do for a smaller guy, or potentially giving up and hauling it in to clean out their space for a new crop here in a couple of months.
What are you hearing about conditions in the field at this time?
Pollination seems to have gone very well. I think we've had good enough moisture. Now, obviously, we're not all the way pollinated across east central Illinois, but for the most part, we've had a very good pollination. The concern becomes we don't have much rain in the forecast. I've noticed guys been asking for rain, and you get hit or miss showers. Don't get me wrong. We had a storm that built to the east of us on Thursday towards Vermilion County, and then there was some rain to the south and east of us last night, but it's not widespread enough, and I think people are going to be a little bit nervous without a drink soon due to, you know, having moisture for ear fill. So corn could change in a hurry, but overall still feel pretty good about it.
You know, if we were to get the rainfall and we say pretty good or normal going into the rest of the season, how early do you think corn will come off?
I think you could see some corn the first week of September, to be honest. I think the early corn in April has advanced very well. If we get some nice moisture to fill it out here towards the end of July, I think we'll see some early corn then.
You think they'll be paying some quick chips too?
Could. I think it depends on the qualities that you see at the commercial elevators, depending on if they want to continue to blend and attract some new bushels. I think that's a definite possibility.
What are your bids for the day?
Bids tonight, we are 368 cash corn, fall corn 362, cash soybeans 996, fall beans 931.
Thanks so much.
Thanks, Todd.
That's Brian Stark. He's with the Andersons right here in Champaign County. Joins us on the Closing Market Report on a Monday afternoon. In just a couple of minutes, we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast when we talk with the folks at Chesapeake Energy up in Chicago, Illinois. They're on the 23rd floor of the Boeing building, looking out across the skyline and the lake.
It's National Pecan Pie Day. On this day in agricultural history in 1730, Josiah Wedgwood was born, an English inventor, artist, world-renowned pottery designer and manufacturer. His daughter, Susanna, was the mother of Charles Darwin. In 1854, George Eastman was born, an American inventor and industrialist. He patented rolled film and the Kodak camera. He founded the Eastman Kodak Company, which held sway over the film industry for decades. In 1859, William Goodale of Massachusetts patented a paper bag manufacturing machine. At one time, this was a very hot field of research, really. In 1861, George Washington Carver was born. an African-American botanist, educator, agricultural chemist, and inventor. He developed hundreds of uses for peanuts, soybeans, and sweet potatoes. He established the George Washington Carver Research Foundation at Tuskegee for agricultural research. In 1873, it was reported that it rained frogs in Kansas City, Missouri. And in 1934, Ole Evinrude died. He invented the first practical outboard motor in 1909. The idea came to him while rowing a boat to a picnic one day. He decided there must be an easier way to move a small boat on the water. And that's this day in agricultural history.
This is the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is a Monday afternoon. Mark Russo of Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois, joins us to take a look at the agricultural weather forecast. Thanks for being with us, Mark.
Oh, my pleasure, Todd.
It's kind of a nice day outside today.
Yeah, kind of a normal summer day here across much of Illinois, let alone the Midwest here. Temperatures climbing up into the mid to upper 80s with some 70s up north. From a rainfall standpoint, a few scattered thunder showers around, primarily western belt. But overall, some scattered activity this week, but it is hit or miss. So depending on if you're under the influence of one of these thunderstorms, obviously you get some rain. Else you're outside and you pretty much get nothing. So it's either feast or famine here situation, especially from a regional standpoint.
Am I right that from here to the east and northeast that things are a bit drier than we'd like them to be?
Well, in different areas here, yeah, particularly eastern belt, which has been on the dry side over the past week to week and a half, some of that is actually an extension of the dryness that has been in place across areas of the Delta, Southeast, and East Coast over the past several weeks. So it's kind of crept westward here over the past week and a half. There is going to be still some opportunities for rainfall. Again, it's going to be a hit or miss situation as we go through the week. Again, for some of your driest acreage, the time frame that has at least the best potential for seeing more significant rainfall is going to occur late this week and over the upcoming weekend. So that's the item, that's the time frame really to focus on here for more significant rain.
And you say hit and miss, does that mean 30-35% coverage, less, more?
Yeah, about 40% coverage or so of the eastern belt here. So yeah, again, it's this if you get hit by rain, obviously you get significant rain, else you totally miss out.
And then anything that we ought to be watching in the western corn belt?
Yeah, what we're watching here is as we go into next week, model indications here are unanimous with producing a stronger ridge of high pressure, building into the plains, and then progressing eastward. So that is going to heat up the western belt, especially the southwestern areas of the Midwest, from around I-80 south and west into the plain states. That's where we see temperatures climbing up to and above 95 degrees Fahrenheit on several days here as we go through next week. Even actually this week, you'll see a day here, Wednesday and possibly even the Thursday, where we see a brief surge of heat. That'll cool down over the weekend before next week really is the hottest time frame here coming up. So that's something to keep an eye on as well, too, as far as what those kind of peak maximum temperatures are going to occur next week.
Can you check in on the Chinese crop and tell me how the growing region in the Northeast is doing?
Well, we've seen over the past several weeks crop conditions deteriorate across northeastern China, both for corn and soybeans. A lot of that has to do with a general dry trend in recent weeks across that area and some significant heat, especially in areas of the North China Plain. We are seeing some relief as we go through later on this week on through the early portion of next week as a surge of monsoon moisture comes from the central and southern areas of China and flows northeastward, and that looks to produce a widespread heavy rain event across some of the driest acreage in China. So along with that, also a little bit of cooler temperatures as well. So it looks like their crops are going to be stabilized as we go into the upcoming weekend.
Thanks so much, Mark.
You're welcome, Todd.
Mark Russo is with Chesapeake Energy in Chicago, Illinois. Joins us here on the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. Stay with us if you can for the Farming World. Otherwise, listen to it at willag.org. This is the Farming World news and interviews from the Land Grant at Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Today, we'll talk with Kevin Spafford. He's the lead for the Farm Journal Electronic Media Legacy Project. It is a series of regional succession planning workshops for farmers. They're all scheduled for this year. Mr. Spafford, thank you so much. Where are you joining us from today?
Actually, from Chico, California.
What is succession planning?
Succession planning is actually positioning the farm, the owners, and the family for a transition from one generation, the current generation, to the next generation. And that's in its most simple form.
And how were you involved then with Farm Journal Electronic Media? Most of our listeners will know Farm Journal. Some of their magazine projects probably will understand both AgWeb, which is one of their many websites, and then AgDay, which is their television program.
Farm Journal has initiated or launched what they call the Farm Journal Legacy Project. It actually crosses all of their media properties, from their electronic properties, what you call AgWeb, to their magazines, to broadcast, including a TV show. And is what the Legacy Project is all about. It's all about getting farmers good information, some real solid resources and tools that they can use to start or initiate the succession planning process. It's really to encourage farmers to engage in the process on a long-term basis.
Why did Farm Journal decide this was important enough to push?
Well, there's a couple of things at work, Todd. Frankly, it's the demographic. The average farmer in the country is in his late 50s. We see most people probably in their early 60s. The transition is coming. There's been, for the most part, if you look at statistics, historical statistics will tell you that failure is, it's very, very difficult. About 30% will pass from first generation to second, which means we lose about 70%. About, of those 30 that might survive, we're going to lose 90% in the transition from second to third. And in the dismal few that might survive that, we're going to lose another 96% third to fourth. So it's critically important that farmers have some help, that these families with kind of what we call it dissimilar objectives can come together around this farm and say, what's really the goal for the family operation, and how do we pass it from this generation to the next generation as a going, and then we change that to growing concern.
Can we talk some about those stats to begin with? So you say that 70% of the farmers are not successfully passed down. Why is that the case? And does that mean that 70% aren't meant to be passed down, that the farm is just broken up and then sold because the children aren't interested, or there are other things at work in that 70% number?
You know, in all our studies, there are three big broad reasons why they don't pass. Number one is inappropriate estate planning. Most estate planning is not done for succession. It's done to minimize or mitigate the estate tax. If you look at that compared to how you would do it for succession, what a normal estate plan does, frankly, is divide and destroy the operation amongst all the heirs in a family instead of keeping the farm intact as an operating unit under the management, guidance, or control of active family members. So that's number one. Number two is the same thing that kills most small businesses across Main Street, across America, and that is insufficient capitalization. We don't have a well or a resource of money to weather the storms or some of the difficulties of succession. And number three, and probably the most overlooked of all of those, is we have, and failed is probably a strong word, but it's the right word, we failed to prepare the next generation for a leadership role. We all know that agriculture is changing, and it's changing at a rapid pace, just like everything else in our society. Well, if somebody's going to step in and take over a multi-million-dollar operation, they need years of preparation, particular training, and probably the right education. And oftentimes we do it like we did in the old days, you know, kind of a good upbringing and a strong back, and you can take over the farm. Well, that's not the case today.
Let's take those up in order of sorts. Inappropriate estate planning, you suggested that it was set to minimize the taxes, the estate taxes, in the planning, but not to make sure that the family farm passed down in, I don't know whether it was in properties that would be in the hands of an operator or an active family member, or what's the difference, I suppose, is the question between those two things. Instead of keeping it in the control of an active family member as opposed to having it set up to minimize the estate tax.
Well, in most cases, most estate plans are set up to minimize or mitigate the estate tax, which means that what we do is we gift, in most cases, to do that. Let's just take a real simple thing. We gift to all of our heirs, and we gift over time so that active and inactive owners share ownership equally. Well, then at death, or when the operation is eventually passed, it's passed to all of a person's heirs. Some of those folks really are not interested in the farm. Some have moved away, and some of it look at it as an asset, and how do I turn this asset into cash? Well, as soon as you do that, I mean, for an average family with four kids, one of them is usually active, three are inactive, you've got three folks that would like to see the farm turned into cash and or return something comparable to what they might be able to get in the outside world, and that's just not realistic. So how do we do that? A lot of times we get into things like, how do we do what we call equal versus fair? How do we make sure that folks that are active on the farm can still maintain operational control? We call it operational control, while the other kids, the inactive family members, get some kind of an other distribution or some kind of other property that kind of makes up for that. One of the things that, as we focus on estate planning, and I don't want to get lost in this, Todd, but it's really important to understand that succession planning and estate planning are two completely separate things. When we talk about succession, we're talking about maintaining the integrity of the operation, creating the next generation's leaders, making sure that the family's financially secure. Estate planning is simply that. So it's an element of succession, which is, how do we mitigate the estate tax? But when we do it in a succession plan, we do it so that we can still maintain operational integrity and control with the active family members. And it sounds like a subtle difference. It's critically important.
What are the keys to making that happen? How do you pull that off?
Boy, that's a tough one. And that's really probably one of the toughest things that we face, is how do we pull that off? Is it starts with a lot of conversation. And really it starts with a family meeting so that, again, active and inactive, and you don't want to point fingers because there's no judgment here, but active and inactive family members understand, I guess, the different objectives or different points of views that they might have as we talk about succession. Parents, and I'm a parent right now myself, but parents always want to think that, well, I'm going to be fair to my kids. Well, when you say that, fair is different than equal, but that's the easiest thing to do is say, oh, I'm going to distribute all my assets equally. I'm going to treat everybody the same. And that's not always easy to do. What we try and do is what we call give voice to the operation. And if the farm is as this, you know, it doesn't really have a voice, somebody has to speak in its place as the family might talk about what's best for the future. So if that operation is what's, let's call it, fed, clothed, provide the income and the lifestyle and the traditions and everything else there is that have brought this family to this point, we don't want to destroy it through this process. What we want to do is really grow it, enhance it, and make it better for everybody. And that's active and inactive. And there is a place at the table for both. It just takes some understanding of each other or each side's point of view.
What are the common misunderstandings between the active and inactive family members?
What active hope is, they hope that the inactive see that it's a business entity that needs to be run and operated, and that they need to be fairly compensated, which is fair. What inactive see is oftentimes they see an asset on a balance sheet that does not return enough and may actually cost them money to hold. So they look at that and say, well, wait a minute, I'm going to hold on to this so that you, my brother or sister, can run the farm. I might be billed for taxes or extra this or some kind of an expense that I didn't necessarily generate, and it's not really necessary for me to have. So how do we create a bigger family operation and integrate the needs of each side of that equation?
That's a tough haul. I'm thinking about how that happens. I mean, if you've got inactive members, they may want to build a home. They may want to invest in their own business. And you've got a property, probably a farm, that may be owned by one or all of them. And what are the things that need to happen in the conversation up front so that everybody understands what's going to happen with parcels that are part of a larger farm that may be just seen as that asset by an inactive member?
You know, the first thing we do, and it sounds kind of harsh when we say that, is first off, an inheritance is not a right. You know, so you kind of have to back away from that for a little bit and say, hey, I've created my life. I'm an adult, and I've created my life away from or apart from, as an inactive, apart from the operation. So to count on what's there or what's part of the operation as mine is a little bit premature. So then from there, we help dad or mom, whoever's running the operation or making these decisions, look at, again, voice to the operation, look at the operation as a whole, and how do we, first off, make sure that the operation is strong enough to weather succession. You kind of stabilize the operation. We work on getting debt down, getting profits where they need to be, getting the right management structure in place. And then we start looking at, with that management structure, do we have a real operating agreement? Do we have, right, let's call it proper lease agreements? And then supported by, and the whole thing has to be supported by, the right kind of a buy-sell agreement between today's current active members, but then tomorrow's heirs, if you will, and making sure that the farm can afford the transition for those that want to transition out and turn their inheritance into cash. And then also the operating agreement protects those inactive members that say, you know what, I don't want to turn it into cash. I'd love to have just lease on my property, and I want to hold on to it as part of my inheritance, as part of my legacy for my kids at some point. So one of the things that is we almost, I hate to speak of it as it's a miracle, but we call it the miracle of commitment. And once a family steps in and says, we want to engage in the succession planning process, we open up a whole new level of conversation that the family's never had before, or if they have had it, it's on a cursory level, and it's kind of with a what's in it for me attitude rather than a, hey, wait a minute, if this is the goose that laid the golden egg that helped the family to be at this point, how do we take care of the goose first? And so it becomes a bigger issue. The bigger issue becomes, how do we strengthen the operation? Then maybe, how do I get my piece? And what does my piece really look like? It might not be cash. It might be ownership for the future for my own kids, or, you know, my own legacy moving forward.
We're talking here today on The Farming World with Kevin Spafford. He's the lead for the Farm Journal Electronic Media Legacy Project. It's a series of regional succession planning workshops for farmers scheduled for this year. We'll talk more about the dates and times and places when we return.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
Here's something of interest from the University of Illinois.
University of Illinois agricultural engineer Kay Bellario thinks it might be possible to teach corn to fix its own nitrogen, eliminating the need for nitrogen fertilizer applications. He's working in an emerging area of engineering called synthetic biology. Bellerio's research focuses on building systems in which bacteria behave like amplifiers. The bacteria sense the presence of an amino acid in their environment and produce a protein in response. A positive feedback mechanism in the gene circuit amplifies the production of that protein. A specific application being investigated is the design of a system that enables nitrogen-fixing bacteria to communicate with the root systems of corn plants. Soybean fixes its own nitrogen. Bellerio is working on teaching corn to do it too, to reduce the need for the application of petroleum-based fertilizers, which has huge implications for sustainable agriculture. And that's Something of Interest from the University of Illinois.
Something of Interest is a public service of the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences at the University of Illinois.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
This is the Farming World News and Interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking about legacy planning and succession planning with Kevin Spafford. He's the lead for the Farm Journal Electronic Media Legacy Project. There are a series of meetings scheduled across the United States in the coming months to take a look at succession planning. I'll go through those dates now. In July, they're on the 22nd in Lincoln, Nebraska, the 21st in Des Moines, Iowa, July the 23rd here in Champaign, Illinois, the 25th in Columbia, Missouri, that's of August, the 27th in Wichita, Kansas, and there are plans in works for Indianapolis, Columbus, and Lansing in the month of December. You can always visit agweb.com to find all of those dates and more information. Mr. Spafford, thank you for being with us. When we last spoke, we were in the midst of talking about appropriate estate planning. There are a couple of other things to go through on that. I'm wondering, you suggested at one point that before the succession would be put into place, that one of the things that needed to be planned for was how the farm would operate and what the agreements would look like. Am I right on that? And not on how it was passed down, but actually the operation or management of the farm. Is that correct?
Yes, it is, actually. And again, we really, in our conversation so far, have really kind of hit on the inappropriate estate planning. What we really want to focus on with succession is how do we plan that transition so that it's kind of what we call smooth and seamless as the farm grows into the future. See, most people, in fact, most farmers I know absolutely passionately love what they do. So to think about hanging it up or putting it away is a tough thing for them, but we all know we're not going to take it with us. So how do we step back gradually, not quit, not retire, but step back and take a different role in the operation? And that role becomes grooming the next generation, grooming the successor, building and stabilizing the operation so that it continues to grow in the future, not fall and stumble through an unplanned succession or transition that we're going to try and cobble together too late.
Okay, so part of the succession planning lands on initially on the mother or the father, whoever is the primary manager of the farm, to pick appropriately the manager or managers. It may, if you have several brothers and sisters that are involved in the farm, there may be several of them that might be managers at some point, and to put them into the lead of that operation. That has to happen fairly early on, I would think, in your 50s and your 60s.
It does, but one of the things, and again, a misconception, maybe we should have done this whole presentation on this, but one of the misconceptions is that I, as dad or mom, have to choose this person or the anointed one or whatever you want to call it, the heir apparent, and that's absolutely not true. It's not necessarily the parent's responsibility for succession. In fact, we go through a lot of work with younger farmers that we call them aspiring farmers. In whose responsibility is it to initiate the succession planning process? And who should be most interested in making sure that we get a completed, implemented plan and that we're kind of going through the process? And I'm not sure that it's grandma or grandpa who are usually still involved in the farm. I'm not even sure it's parents. But I'm really, really certain that if I'm a 20, 30, or early 40-something-year-old, and I'm investing my life, my work, my career in creating this farming operation that's bigger than we've ever had before, I want to make sure that succession's in place so that I can look out in the future and know with some sense of certainty that this operation can, will survive as we go through transition. So whose responsibility is the succession? It may be parents. It may be grandparents. It's definitely a young person's. And you say, how do they do that? How do they can initiate the conversation, and they can also make sure that they're prepared to assume a leadership role in the future and go through some development process that they've predetermined that's going to help them grow into where they need to be. And, you know, I just had recently on the TV show, I had a university professor, and she's the head of the ag department here in town, and she talked about a lot of times we're training young people or educating people for careers that won't exist, that certainly don't exist today and may not actually exist for 10 years into the future. Well, that's the way we have to get in agriculture, is we have to start looking out at these operations and say, what's it going to take to grow into the next version of what this farm needs to become to survive and, of course, thrive into the future?
And finally, we only have maybe a minute and a half left. We didn't hit number two. We talked about estate planning, tax planning, succession planning. We talked about leadership role for the next generation just now, capitalization, and making sure that there's enough money for that farm to survive survive the transition. What are the kind of steps that need to be gone through?
You know, that what we talk about there, Todd, is we always talk about stabilizing the operation, so reducing debt, building a reservoir of capital for growth. Most farmers invest back into their business, and it's wonderful, but we need to make sure that there's some reservoir of capital to weather some of the storms, let's call it, of succession. I mean, every operation is going to be tested as we go through this. There's going to be some stumble and fall, and then as we transition to new management, then we're going to make a few mistakes. So do we have that reservoir? Do we have some capital to fall back on when we do make some of those mistakes, or make some investment as we diversify the operation to become a little bit bigger?
Mr. Spafford, thank you, and good luck when you're on the road.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Kevin Spafford is the lead for the Farm Journal Legacy Project at farmjournallegacyproject.com. He's been talking with us here on The Farming World. You have a good afternoon. I'm Todd Gleason.